This is work that is joint with my colleagues Nate Coelho from Murray Stokely from Google. So basically what is this is talking about is how to collect, to estimate aggregate metrics in a system using sample distributed tracing system like Dapper. And for the benefit, probably most people don't know what Dapper is, so I will explain that too. So here's the high level problem. So sometimes you have this large distributed system like we do at Google, and you know people do in all kinds of places, and you're trying to measure something. You know something happened. You're trying to figure out did something go wrong here, or you're trying to find out is this an interesting thing to measure. Whatever. There are many reasons why you might be trying to measure some aggregate system quantity. Some you're trying to find out were the cache misses by this user which had these characteristics going to this partition. Where did they go up by a large amount yesterday or when such and such happened, right? You may not have, in theory, if you wanted to, you could go and measure this. If you had instrumented your system, you could go and actually have measured that exactly. But maybe you didn't do it in advance. Maybe you didn't have the perfect foresight to have built it. And in any case, it takes a lot of effort to build in a special measurement like that. Even if you could do it, you may not want to do it because there's a lot of paraphernalia that you have to build to do that and deal with the high data volumes and stuff like that. So what we have at Google, not built for this purpose, but for other purposes, is this system called Dapper. So Dapper is an always-on system for sample distributed tracing, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. But basically, we collect a small fraction of all the RPCs that go through the system and log them in fair detail, right? So if a user had an uncached hit, a miss to particular partition, all those details are probably logged in there, assuming the developer thought to put all of that in there. And given enough of these, you can go ahead and estimate the rate at which these things were happening yesterday and the day before and whatever, right? The question that comes in is that once we have this, how do you estimate the uncertainty in the estimate that you've come up with? Right? First of all, how do you do the estimate? But that's actually not that hard at all. It's reasonably obvious. What is a little less obvious is how you estimate the uncertainty. And this is what the technical portion of this paper is about. So just to start with, let me describe what Dapper sampling is. So basically, you have an RPC, a high-level RPC that somebody generated for whatever purposes. It causes further RPCs to be generated in underlying systems. And so it has some descendant RPCs, et cetera. What Dapper does is that there's an ID associated with the top level RPC which gets propagated all the way through, and a certain probability is applied, generally based on the developer's intuition about what rate of at what rate these RPCs should be sampled, and so you can with that probability that RPC sample. Now, what happens is that if the trace ID, which is this whole thing is called a trace, and if the trace ID, which is based on the top level RPC's ID, is selected for tracing, then it's traced all the way through, right? You don't just get the top level one; you get all the ones, subsequent ones too. So now you have a certain rate at which all these RPCs are being sampled, and supposing you wanted to find out that the RPCs with a particular characteristic, how many of them were there during this hour yesterday? Well, you can go, because these are logged, you can go and look to see how many did I measure. You know what the sampling rate was, so you just invert that to get the rate at which you're getting it. So that's straightforward, right? So that's the very simple case. But what complicates life a little bit is that these rates are not uniform all through, okay? It is possible for the developers or sometimes the system administrators of the systems that these pass through, because these B and C may all be in different systems, maybe in different data centers even, they can go and modify them for various reasons, because maybe they want more detail on particular things. So the rates might, although you're sampling based on the trace ID, you can change the sampling rates at different points in time. So it's possible that a trace wasn't sampled till a certain point and then started getting sampled below that, or else that it was sampled up to a certain point and then started not getting sampled below that. And there is yet a third kind of, so basically what that means is that the sampling rate is different, could be different in the different parts of the system. Typically, there are not more than a couple or two or three different sampling rates, but there could be in theory. And yet another complication arises because there might be some parts of the system that are under pressure. So the system administrator, the operator of that data center, might decide, you know, I'm going to cut down everybody's rates by 50%. Okay. Or what is even more likely is that the Dapper collection system in that data center might be under pressure. So they might say, well, you know, we can't handle the rate at which we are getting it. We're just going to reduce the rates across the board. So this ends up with, you know, several, with at least two different parameters at each point where, so basically you have two probabilities. One is a server-based sampling probability. So for at each server, there's a probability that this trace will be sampled. And then you have a overall sampling probability that is a second one. And you have to satisfy both of them before they sample it. And this complicates the life in both in terms of estimating the original value, as well as more complicated estimating the uncertainty in it. So let's give you an example of the use of this. So where would you use this? So supposing, and this was real. I say supposing, but this is an actual example of what happened. There was a certain a set of disk partitions which saw a sudden increase in the rate of there was some change happened, and we are trying to find out. We think this might possibly cause some rate of increase in this partition being accessed. Did it actually happen? And where did it happen? So we're sort of trying to look day to day to see which days did it shoot up, if any. And looking at it, so what we're showing there is that the blue graph is showing you the actual number of accesses there were, and the red one is showing the ratio, the day to day ratio, right? So one day the ratio jumped by 65 times. It went to 65. So obviously there was a change over there. In another case, it went up to 300. So maybe there's also a change over there. But the problem is that these are sampled. It could just be sampling error. Was one of them real? So here's what we, this is how we apply the test that we are talking about. So basically, what we do is if we want to check whether it increased and we want to exclude, you know, small increases which happened due to small workload variations, et cetera, let's say, okay, it has to increase by at least 10% for it to be significant. The test that you're trying to apply is that it went up by 10%. So the way we look at it is, okay, so the null hypothesis is that if it is less than 10%, we want to reject it. And now we are... This test that we are applying is on the estimate, right? We are actually trying to remove all the cases where the real measurement, the actual number did not go up by 10%. But all we have is the estimate because we only have the samples. So that's what we are trying to reject. And so basically what you do is you take this difference, this quantity, which is based on 2 days measurements, estimates from 2 days, and you try to find out what the confidence interval is basically in it. And basically, if we look at the or the standard error, which is a different way of looking at it. And basically, if you assume that this the error in this is normal, then you say, okay, if the difference is above the standard the standard deviation that we expect, the standard error that we expect in the estimates by a certain margin, then it was a real increase. If the change was smaller than the variation that we expect due to sampling, then we don't know, right? So that's basically what we are applying over here. So here's what actually happened. So there we are plotting the red score now is plotting the z-score, which is a standard error measurement. And it turns out that the case where it went up by a factor of 65 was actually real because it persisted. It went up and then it stayed up. Whereas the case where it went up by a factor of 300 was actually just a sampling error. Okay? So, because at least that's what it appears to be, because it was a blip and the next day it went back to and the changes that were happening were persistent. So if it was a real change, then we would have expected the change in the actual IO rate to also have persisted, right? So in this was a case where, you know, using the sampling method, finding the confidence interval and checking that the difference is actually large enough to compensate for the error in the sampling did give correct answers. So let me give you another application of this, which is that supposing you're trying to do a bin packing. Now, this is a purely the numbers in here that I will show you are they're sort of real, but I will explain how. So supposing you're trying to do a bin packing. You have multiple data centers, and you have multiple users, and they generate requests for data. And you want to pack them so as to minimize the cross-data center traffic. I mean, that's not the only consideration. That's just one of the considerations, but it is one consideration. So for this example, we just said, okay, let's just focus on that one, right? How would you do it? How would you figure out what would do it? And now, remember, you only have the sample data, right? So in general, what you might do is that if you have j possible, a number of possible policies that you are going to use, and you want to test which one works the best, okay? So what you could do is to apply them all across the traces that you have and that you have stored over the past week, let's say. And say, for the past week, how many would these have, how many cross data center IOs would each of these have produced? And then you can say which one, okay, so which one was the lowest? But again, the question comes in, is the difference that you're seeing between two policies real or is it just sampling error? Right? It's in some sense the same question, right? And so again, you want to see whether the differences, whether the sampling errors swamp the differences that you're seeing. So we just made up two example strategies. Now, these are not real strategies, okay? These are, when you look at them, you see they're obviously simplistic. But this is just for the purpose of example. So one of them was a basic first fit strategy. You take a user's and just stick them in alphabetically. The other was a strategy which actually looks at how many IOs was user A making to data that belonged to user B. And so in that case, should we put them in the same data center or not? Okay. So if they were making a lot of IOs to each other's data, then it may be a good idea to put them in the same data center. If they're not, it doesn't matter, right? And then you start packing them according to that and didn't do a greedy bin packing based on that. And obviously, in this case, you expect the second turn one to work better. But I mean, does it? Does the data actually bear out that it actually makes a difference, right? So here was another one where there is a null hypothesis over here, too, which is that what you're seeing here is the difference between the two divided by the average number of the average number of cross data center IOs for overall, just to normalize it, since the actual number was not relevant. And the null hypothesis here is that if that dot in the middle of this dot, for example, were over here, that would mean that the basic one is actually doing better, right? If it were somewhere around here, and if this confidence interval were actually straddling this, that would basically mean we don't know. There's too much sampling error. We can't tell. But because it consistently stays above this line, so therefore we know that this policy consistently works better. So let me talk a little bit about details. I won't go into the details of the derivation and all of that. It's not something you can present easily. But so basically what happens is that, going back to my original picture, you have two parameters for each one. One is the server sampling probability, and one is the the downsampling probability. And your trace ID, you create two hashes, and which are between 0 and 1, and basically you need to both they both need to be less than. It needs to be basically the two hashes need to fit in this portion, right? If you map it to the square, one of the hashes mapped across this side and one of the hashes mapped across this side, the one corresponding to the server sampling probability has to fit within, it has to be lower than this to be sampled. Ignore this rectangle. I'm only talking about this rectangle for the moment, right? It has to be in this, below this, to be sampled. And again, similarly, it has to be inside this. So for the case where So figuring out whether or not each one should be sampled is straightforward. The more interesting question is, how do you figure out the covariance, which is what you need between different ones, right? Whether or not they're correlated or not, right? Because you have some traces which will match both of them, and now you have to figure that out. Now the case where they are in different traces turns out to be simple, that you got one access in one trace and one access in another trace turns out to be simple because whether or not any trace is picked is independent. So then those computations are simple. The complication comes in more in the case when they're both to be found in the same trace, and then you want to find out what was the probability that they would both be found in this trace. And so that one, again, turns out to be not all that difficult to do. Basically, the probability, the joint sampling probability of two of them just comes out to be the minimum of the server sampling probabilities times the minimum of the downsampling probabilities. So I'm sorry for not giving you very much more detail, but you have to go through a page of algebra to figure out what actually happens. And you don't actually need to read the details of that. But basically, what happens is that there is a basic algorithm in which basically you're just adding up over all the traces in the system, and it is sort of quadratic in there. But then we find a way to make it simpler by aggregating. It turns out that, I think I'll just go to the next slide. I can't really talk about this. It turns out that what you can do is that for every server sampling and downsampling probability pair, okay, so supposing the server sampling probability is 0.5, it won't be 0.5, it will be, you know, 1 in 10,000, and the downsampling probability is 0.5. You can aggregate all the RPCs for which, all the cases for which this is true, and treat them together as a class, and it's linear within that class. And then you take the next set where the S and D one values are identical. It turns out to be linear within that class. So all you've got to do is to aggregate this, and then for this new set, which is for each S and D pair, you have a covariance probability, then you can do another computation, which is quadratic. But it turns out that the number of these server sampling and downsampling probability pairs, different ones, tend to be fairly small, in the order of tens or hundreds or something like that. So it really doesn't matter very much. And of course, it's also going to be quadratic in the number of pairs. It will depend upon the number of pairs of RPCs that you want to compare against, because obviously, you know, you have as many numbers as you have those pairs. So so the overall, the high level, the immediate conclusions of this is that we can do this aggregated sampling, and calculate these aggregates from samples when direct measurements are not available, and we can estimate the errors in them, and I give you a couple of examples. But really, that's just the bottom level conclusion. The part that I haven't written down over here, which is really what is more interesting, is the fact that these ubiquitous sampling, distributed sampling systems are incredibly useful. I mean, I didn't build this. Somebody else built this at Google. They would build them primarily for debugging purposes. But we find that we can use them for all kinds of purposes because they're always there. The data is available anytime. So you can go and look at it and come up with all kinds of interesting things, which is more performance related. And one of the issues with the original one was because, you know, these sampling probabilities tend to be quite small. They have to be because you're doing it all the time and you're storing them, right? So the issue always was, are you going to miss a rare event? The interesting events quite often are rare. Are you going to miss them? And there was a bit of faith involved here. Well, I mean, you know, if it happens often enough, you'll actually catch them. But then you still want to know, what is the error with which you're catching them? You're catching them, but are you catching them with the same frequency that they're actually happening? And asymptotically, that's obviously correct, but, you know, you're not going to collect an infinite number of samples. So I think it is very useful in a large system to do this kind of logging, distributed sampled logging, to be able to, after the fact, go and estimate quantities which you hadn't thought about. So, generally useful thing. We use it all the time. That's it.
Hi, thanks for that talk. Mark Cherini, Harvard. Do you have any sense of how the temporal granularity affects your hypothesis testing? In other words, if I were to compare rates for different hours, I/O rates for different hours, how it may affect the Z-score, for example?
I think it would depend upon how large is, in other words, how rare the event was that you're trying to test for. If it's something which happens all the time, I mean, you know, there are literally billions of RPCs going across per hour.
Your infrastructure, for example.
Yeah, then you're fine, right? If you're something where you're looking for something very specific, and this is something we actually ran into, where there are some things that we're looking for, and we decided, you know, even in a day, there just were not enough RPCs for us to make. So we had to go to 10-day intervals before we could make comparisons. So it all depends upon what is the granular, how many you have.
But so what, I mean, like if you're talking about like moving to a granularity of, say, a month for something, what is the impact of finding one or two examples of what you're looking for, as opposed to things that are happening on a frequent basis?
I'm not entirely sure I understand your question. I mean, what I'm talking about here are aggregates.
Yeah.
As opposed to finding specific events that happened. In other words, I'm not looking for the thing where one thing happened. I'm looking for the case where 1,000 things happened out of a billion cases.
Right. So it's always, there's, not always, but you want to find some sort of proportionality where the significance is enough that, in other words, 1,000 out of a billion in this case is good enough, but, you know, 500 out of a billion is not.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. So let me ask about a somewhat different use case. Are you familiar with GPROF
and Statistical? Yes.
Okay, so how, I mean, are these techniques, would they allow us to make better estimates of, you know, the actual performance profiles for, you know, loops?
I suppose so, yeah. If there were, I mean, what we are sampling here are RPCs, right? So the question is whether there are, whether that the thing that you're doing includes, it wouldn't help you for GPROF, which is, I have not used GPROF for RP, where RPCs were involved myself, at least.
Well, but okay, in GPROF case, some thing happens, so this would be, a certain count of events happens. There could be seconds, it could be joules, it could be cache misses.
Right.
And every so many, you have an interrupt.
Right.
And so that's about all you get.
Yeah, so I'm just saying that you could, I could interpret your question in two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Would it make sense to do some kind of logging which would allow you to do a much, a more real version of GPROF so that you're testing it in on actual production, in
for
an
example,
actual production environment? Because this is only looking at RPCs, right? If there's no RPC inside your loop, it won't see it.
Right.
Right.
Well, RPC is just yet another event that we're talking about. I mean, right now you're doing like confidence intervals on RPCs, and I'm thinking confidence intervals on now the GPROF use case.
Certainly true, but it has to be sampled.
Right, yeah, like once in every 1,000 cache misses. Yeah,
right, yeah. I don't see why you couldn't use the same techniques.
Okay. All right, cool. All
right.
Anybody else? All right, well, thank you very much.